This is 1360 AM.
WNJC. Washington Township. Philadelphia. Philadelphia's Renaissance Radio Station. Brought to you from Forsyth Broadcasting. Or listen to us at WNJCRadio.com.
All right, welcome. This is your host, Will Hemingway, and you are listening to the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. No tinfoil hats here, no ranting rhetoric, simple, stoic, thoughtful enlightenment on training in risk management, preparedness, and proactive survival. Survival is every day, so live well. The Practice Preparedness Radio Show comes to you live every Tuesday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Time on WNJC 1360 AM, South Jersey, Philadelphia. As always, listen to us live on the internet via my website, practicepreparedness.com. We stream every time on TuneIn. Find a link on our website via the Listen Live button, or if you are in the Delaware Valley, you can listen live at 1360 on your AM radio. As always, you can stream the past shows. You will find them archived on the website under show notes or select one from the scrolling list on the website's right column. Thanks for joining us. I am your host, Will Hemingway. I want to stimulate your little gray cells. Let's get started. Good evening, I am your host, Will Hemingway, and this is Practice Preparedness. As usual, as I said earlier, you can visit us on the web at practicepreparedness.com. Every one of the previous shows is on there in the archive. If you click on the button that says Show Notes or move to the right side of the page, the right column has a list of every single show that I have done, all available for you to download and use on your iPod or Android device and be able to play back even when you are offline. So, today I want to talk about a couple of topics I would like to cover, and then our main point will focus on creating a survival and preparedness plan, which I have been trying to make a series of, to bring you through what it takes to actually make a solid plan that is actually going to be reliable and work. But before I get there, I want to talk briefly about a couple of other things. First of all, I want to speak about ticks. Ticks are a threat to your survival. Now, you would think such a tiny little thing can be not that big of a deal, but just like with mosquitoes and other insects, it is really important to understand the long-reaching effects that it will have on your body, on your mind, and your ability to function and survive. Remember, we live in a civilized society that offers you all kinds of opportunities that most people around the world do not even have on a normal basis, let alone during a crisis. You have doctors and hospitals, you have emergency care centers, and all of these other things that are there readily available for you to help you to stop from getting things like RA and simply problems with your brain and your function and blood and so forth. So remember, it's critical to have a base of knowledge. And the base of knowledge comes into play when something happens. You don't panic. You don't get in a situation where you run around in circles trying to figure out what to do because the phones don't work and nobody's at the hospital available. They're only taking critical care patients. These things can change your life, or they can be minor bumps in the road if you have skills that you can do something for yourself. Maybe you don't have the skill to do some things, but others in your close circle do. Someone in your group who will be present and available for you must have these basic skills in order to head off potential for bigger problems that you won't be able to handle later and will be game changers or game enders. So next week, I'm going to be bringing on a couple who designed and created the Pro Tick Tool Remedy. It's my chosen device for removing ticks. If you have one that sets on you, your animals, your pets, it works. It's reliable. It's very reasonably priced. And it's simple to carry. It's small. And like I said, it's just reliable. And it doesn't hurt that it was designed, created, patented, and is manufactured right here in the United States, right here in Pennsylvania. It's up in the Pocono Mountains where they are located, and they're just great people. I like to support people who do good things and are real people, real family people, and care about others, including you. So that'll be next week. So let's, one other thing that I wanted to comment upon before we get into the primary point of the day is what we just came out of. Since I've spoken last on the air, we had a very, very major electrical storm strike us in gamma rays and EMF that came in a major storm coming from the sun that struck us. There was a really, really large hole in the sun that was a flare, a big solar flare that blew out all this material that created a wave of electromagnetic interference on the Earth. It bombarded us. If you want to see something really interesting, go find spaceweather.gov and go look online there. It is a stunning thing. They have all kinds of computer mock-ups of how the waves struck, the ratings, the measurements that happened all over the Earth, and the way it impacted us. It was at a G5 level and even pushed higher. These things threaten communications. It's equivalent to an EMP in a lot of cases, but a low-level one. It can cause you to lose your connections on your cell phone. It can cause all kinds of havoc to electronic devices, and then it goes away when it stops. And you don't have any idea of why your clocks and your watches went out of time because it messed up their clocks. It is important for you to become aware of how these things impact you, because even on the most moderate side, it affects you in the fact that if you work outside, if you are gardening, if your job takes you to work outside, if you're a laborer, you are being exposed to UVA, UVB waves. You are being exposed to infrared waves from the sun, and you're also being exposed to electromagnetic waves that are affecting and altering the way that your cells and your body are created. And as your cells die and new ones are forming, even in your 60s and your 70s, you're still building brain neurons and you're building tissue cells all over your body. If they are messed up when you are growing them in their inception point because of electromagnetic frequencies striking your body, they can cause abnormalities that may turn into cancer and other problems that will rear their ugly head down the road. So when you are having a day when there's a G3, a G4, a G5 rating on the space weather, you are actually being bombarded by excessive amounts of radiation that could change those cells. This is why signing up online on the government's website, just go Google space weather, government space weather program predictions, forecasts. You can sign up. It's free. You get them in your email every day. They will tell you what to look for. There are lots of websites that explain it, as well as the government's own space weather site that explains the importance. But if you know that you're having a G4 or a G5 day, that's pretty significant, then you want to find a way to take cover under things that have 2 feet of earth or under a steel roof that's going to deflect it, etc., because you do not want that if you can avoid it in any way, shape, or form. Choosing the days to work outside comes inclusive with the idea of avoiding that space weather. So nothing so far has been reported as major deficits or destruction that has occurred from it. But remember, an EMP or even high electromagnetic waves impacting electronics, what happens is the higher the amount, the higher the frequency of them, the more likely it is that you're going to have damage to your integrated circuits, which are the components that make up basically every piece of electronics that you own. And how is that? Well, because the more integrated these circuits are, the finer and the more microscopic that each one of these circuits are to fit onto a small chip. If you had a 486 computer or an 8286 chip, they were so low density that many of them survived major EMP events, including a transformer exploding right nearby one of them, and it kept on working. Back in the day when we were still running 8086, 8286, 8386 units, I had clients in my computer consulting business who had lightning strike a pole. Lightning is an EMP event. It's rated in joules and gigajoules sometimes of the amount of power, the voltage, and the amperage that comes in that lightning strike. If you want to see something really cool, there's a sidebar note on Twitter. If you go on Twitter and search, or go on Google and search, lightning strike tree fire, you'll find it was all light on Twitter the other day, yesterday, because lightning struck a tree that was hollowed out inside. I guess it was starting to rot, and it lit it on fire in the center of the tree. There's a lot of power going on there, and that power will jump large points. In fact, in tests, in research, those lightning bolts, when they strike metal and it comes down, will jump an air gap sometimes of 3 or 4 inches. In lesser amounts, it will jump shorter distances. But because in order to fit in the new quad-core CPUs, for instance, and computers today, the amount of space in between is less than 1/10, 1/100 sometimes of a human hair. So there's not a lot of spark gap to jump, and that power will jump from one to another, pushing way more power through it than it was designed to take, and will inevitably cause it to fail. This is how it works. Now, if you have good grounding, and if you don't know that, if you live in a house, you can have an electrician, if you have an electrician there at some point, have them check your bonding to ground and maybe even add a second grounding rod, a 9/16 or even larger, a 3/4 inch grounding rod, so that, and then bond the ground to it from the panel, bond the ground from the cold water pipe, so that you can have a high quality ground, because what you have to do in order to have any hope in saving your electronic components, with exception, of course, of putting them in a Faraday cage, is that it's going to find its path first to ground rather than to overheat and exceed and jump and blow up circuits in an integrated circuit. So remember, even your toaster a lot of times has an integrated circuit in it, and many transistors and resistors, all of which will get fried if that power tries to use it to find the shortest path to ground, because that's how it works. It's going to look for the shortest path to ground, and you want to make that really good by making an opportunity for it to take a detour to go straight to ground rather than go through your components. Another thing to have, and I highly recommend, is to have a really high quality surge protector, and preferably a surge protector connected to a very high quality, high standard UPS, uninterruptible power source. My chosen selection of brand is Triplite. That's the one that I think you should get, and I highly recommend it. Triplite, Triplite. They're found around in the higher end stores. Do not trust an APC. They're junk. I've had many a client lose servers and other devices that were connected to them by mere lightning strikes a quarter mile away on a telephone pole. Stick with something that's validated and that works. That's what you need. Get yourself a UPS. It also has a battery in it, so the battery acts as a shock absorber to protect your electronics. In the event of some kind of a catastrophe, a crisis, you want the highest level of opportunity for communication. You do not want your laptop crashing. If your laptop survives the initial strike and you have a way to make power, you can draw up your information. Even if you take it with you and protect it from electromagnetic frequencies, that you can later light it up when you get to the police station or a crisis intake center or whatever, and have all your data available on there. That is useful because it will save your headaches and make your life easier. You should also have a flash drive that has that same data on it. I highly recommend encrypting it so that you can open it when you need to, but if you lose it, others can't make access to your critical data. And have good quality scans of all of your important documents. They may not accept them, but they will at least use them to be able to help you reconstruct them or replace them, because they'll have identifying numbers and codes to be able to speed the process of you getting a new one. So, let me shift to the primary topic today, which is the next step in understanding how to properly create a viable, worthwhile survival and preparedness plan. This is to avoid the circle jerk of going around trying and spending lots of money, lots of effort and time, getting people all frothed up and excited, and in the end, getting absolutely no result that will positively impact your survivability quotient. So, in order to do that, you have to understand a little bit about what it takes to create a plan, whatever kind of a plan it is. And I know that it's going to sound rudimentary, and hearing it, you're going to go, oh, yeah, I know that. But I can tell you that you yourself, likely, handful of you that wouldn't, if you didn't hear this and get reminded of this on a regular basis, when you go to plan anything, you will always break this rule. You will always work from your assumed expectations to create the plan based upon that. What you need to do is start creating a plan by creating it by identifying the goal of your plan. Don't say, oh, I'm going to do this in order to do that. Say, my plan is to survive. All right, what are you going to survive? So you're going to have to break it down. Look at where you live. Look at the regular things that throughout history in the last 5 years, 2 years, 10 years, 100 years have impacted and affected the people who live in your area. So with that in mind, then we look and say, what is it that we're going to protect ourselves from? So, did they have a flood? Did they have wildfires? Did they have civil unrest? If they had all three of them, that means you now have to make first an individual plan in order to survive, and your goal, to reach your goal, which is to survive X. I'm going to survive a tornado. I'm going to survive a flood. And you build a plan based upon that. So this is like hiking in a mountain. And you know that your goal is to get to that peak. Well, you can't always see that peak, but you still know what that goal is. So every once in a while, you stop and get on the highest rock. Or when there's a clearing and you can see far away, you validate that you're still heading in that direction. That's how making a proper plan works. So when you start planning that way, you're looking at and keeping in mind the whole time what your goal is. I am going to survive X. So let's take a basic plan. I'm going to survive a flood. So let's look at the flood. How many floods have happened here? How do we know how we're going to survive the flood? Define the flood. So it's easy enough now with the internet. Let's look and see what floods happened in your region. What floods will likely impact you? So if you live near the Oroville Dam, especially if you live south of it, your life is in a chaos right now. Because again, the Oroville Dam, which is weak and at risk of total failure, is being pressed to its limit because the amount of water that is up on the head side of the dam is exceeding that of its capacity, and it's risking to overrun the dam again, break over the emergency spillway, shut down the power plant permanently or damage it or whatever the case is, and thus create a complete and utter disaster. There were people there who were forcibly evacuated for up to 15 days from their homes because of the imminent threat of that dam failing and wiping out and putting all those homes and all those people under 20 feet of water, rubble, and debris. It's a disaster. What would you do if you were there? My answer is, I wouldn't live there. But okay, that's probably too logical. So what would you do if you want to be able to brag that you live in the Simi Valley, or you live in this, or you live in this area, or you live in Sacramento, which is in the direct line to get nailed by trillions of gallons of water all at one time coming at it in full force, wiping across what would have been a desert plain, now is a floodplain, and completely decimate the properties and lives of all those people living in 40 or 50 cities downline. So when you make your plan, you have to decide what is viable. Because running to the top of your house doesn't work. Jim pointed it out in a conversation we had on the air a few weeks ago that waiting, like in Katrina, they waited. The people who are the EMS begged them to leave, and they refused. Because it was their right. The problem is, if they stay, EMS will be forced, or at least tasked, to go save them. And what are they doing? They're unnecessarily placing those EMS and rescue people under threat, their life under threat, because they were selfish and arrogant. They had no humility. They couldn't say, okay, I'm not happy about this, but I'm going to go because I see that it's not just me. I'm going to put you at threat when you come to save my stupid butt because I'm on the roof of the building spelling out the word help on my roof, food on my roof, because I was the moron who decided to ignore your heat and heed your warning and leave when I could. Again, I would say that from my standpoint, I'd be like, forget it. I drive around in the mountains every time I get, and every time I do, I look down at the valley, and I'm constantly amazed by the fact that they build million-dollar buildings and shopping plazas with big shopping center, big stores like ShopRite and whatever, Piggly Wiggly and Weiss Markets and wherever, depending on the area in the world that you are, and they are at the base of a valley between two high peaks. So tell me something. When you have to have sump pumps just because it rains to keep from flooding the ground level, and when you have to have canals dug and retention basins dug all around those properties to contain the water from a simple rainfall, what does that bode? How does that bode to the overall survivability and reliability of the location if it snows really heavily and then that snow melts? It's a train wreck. Why would you do that? So when you learn about wilderness survival or basic survival skills out in the wild, one of the first things you learn is never pitch camp within 100 feet, preferably 150 feet of the base of the valley. And never pitch camp within 100 to 150 feet below the top of the mountain. You do not want to be on the top of the mountain. Why? because just like being at the bottom where all the water runs to, at the top all the wind comes to, and all the weather comes to as it buffets against the ridges of the mountains. Most people on the East Coast of the United States really do not understand that most places in the world where there are mountain ranges, the weather comes across and slams into the mountain and dumps all over the areas right there by the mountain on whichever side was the way that it was coming from. And it slams into that and then basically stops the weather. If you live in Nevada, you know this well. The weather's constantly coming in from the west across Oregon, Washington State, across California, and slams into the Sierra Nevadas and stops just the same way. In Rapid City, South Dakota, you have the same problem in the other direction. Either it's really dry because nothing comes their way because it all stops on the other side of the mountain, or it comes from the east and it slams into the mountain and they have flooding. So, if we know that this is a case and we have historical record and documentation that you can pull up on the internet from 100 different sources, from local government to national and federal government, you can look up what the FEMA calls are, what the emergency declarations were from the state governor's side, and on and on and on. You can start to look at what the real threats that affect the real area that you are from. Then comes a series of questions. If you are going to stay, or if you are going to leave, and as I always say, there is no real survival unless it's mobile survival. That said, it may not be a good idea for you to be more mobile than to go a few blocks away or to the other side of town. One of the things I think is very underreported and not discussed hardly at all. I know a couple people who I've seen on YouTube videos who have scraped along the surface of it, one or two who really gave it justice, but most of them really do not give justice to the fact that though it sounds like a great idea to run off into the country and live off the land, most people would have about a 2 to 5 day survival rate before they did something really stupid that would end up taking their life or maiming them that would make them completely incapable of surviving at all, and they would perish. So let me take that apart for a second and say that I've spoken about this subject several times in different areas that all overlap because it's a very complicated topic. But think about this. If you live in the city and your day-to-day activities are reflective of what it's like to live in a civilized society, and I'm using that term in quotes here, if you live in the city, but in the end, that you are in a position where you live in a technologically driven, very non-physical driven world. If that's the case, you running to the country when your world consists of debating over who you're going to donate your clothes to that you bought 3 months ago because they're no longer in, they're yesterday, they're all last week now, as people say, because it's just not the end thing. I'm sorry, people, if you go to an Amish country family's home or their location or Mennonites or anything in that range, you'll see them wearing the same handmade blue jean overalls, the bib pants, the same shirts, the same hat as they've all worn for generation after generation. Nobody gives two flying flings whether it's highly fashionable or not. They care about its functionality. Well, it's the same thing with you. If you are so tied up in those things that have no value, they're all just they don't even have an intrinsic value. They're all just surface level things. They're things about what makeup or what clothes or what car I drive, what name badges on my car. Oh, they make fun of me because I don't drive a BMW. Those kinds of things. Then you're not cut out to go to the country to go survive. So don't make the mistake. Figure out a way to focus on surviving in the city. Now, mind you, that may not mean surviving in your apartment or your condo or your brownstone or your house, if you're lucky enough to have one in the city. But understand that any threat that you have from roving, marauding, marauders or people who are racist or culturalist that are going to attack you over those matters, none of them are going to come to, or they're going to pale in comparison to getting into a place where you don't fit in, where you're an outsider, where you won't be accepted, where you will be considered a threat, and where you will be ostracized, so you will have no level of support, no friends, no one you know, and nothing that you can do to help yourself. You will increase the likelihood that you will perish tenfold because of that. And that's really important to consider. So, well, for me, someone saying to me, oh, don't run from the city, you're good, you can stay there, you have guns, you have this, you have that, you can survive. Poppycock, you will not survive. Because for me, from my standpoint, because I don't want to be there now. I would never survive there in this situation, because when they started their stupidity, I would have to go out and do something about it, and then I would put myself at risk and put my family and those who I care about at risk, because they would lose me as a component in their plan. So for a city person, though, this is their place. They're satisfied. They're happy with that. So moving you to the country, if you are one of them, is a massive, massive error. This is why survival planning, preparedness, and readiness is not a cookie-cutter system. It has everything to do with the individual, and each one of those people have their own plan. And what someone else does, whether it's me or Jim or Marco or anyone else, has very little to do with it, because it's irrelevant to you. There may be pieces of it that are fundamentally useful, but in the end, each and every person needs to have a plan that fits who they are, what their perceptions, what their desires, but most importantly, like I said, what is your goal? And I don't mean survive, define survive. Define, I want to have electricity, I want to have lights, I want to have my computer, I want to have a roof over my head, I want to have heat, I want to have these things. Or you could just simply have absolutely nothing, because it's not going to work. This is how it turns out. So these are things you have to think about when you go to plan. So let's take a little look at the first steps of making a good plan. And there are other things that I've discussed before that can be used a little before and a little after, but these are the fundamental parts. So preparedness and readiness. So right now, the most recent definitions of the two words, preparedness and readiness, imply that they are synonyms. In other words, for those of you who don't know, that means they mean the same thing. They are not. There is an important difference. Be careful to not conflate preparedness with readiness. And if you don't know what conflate means, that means to confuse, to mix the two together as one. That's what they've done, even Merriam-Webster's dictionary. I believe it's probably because it's way too complicated to put in a one-sentence definition, so they just left it at that and moved on. And the funny thing is, when they say preparedness, when you look for the definition of readiness, it says preparedness is the first thing in the Merriam-Webster dictionary. This does not do it justice, because the two terms are components of the same plan to survive. Both are important. But while the dictionaries have conflated them, the subtle differences count. The difference between the two is about the focus. Passive versus active, and that's critical. The only way that you will ever be able to develop a viable security plan is to do so thoughtfully and with a clear understanding of how to succeed. Like I said, most people fail because they don't have formal training in planning. That's fine if you don't, but learn, educate yourself in how to plan. My advice, which has worked really well for 3 decades in business, training others, is to say that you have to adhere You have to adhere to the following approach, and that's this. Develop a plan that considers adaptability to variables in the plan. And the way you do that is by looking at the goal, focusing on the goal, writing down the goal, elaborating on what the goal means, because as I already said, surviving is not the goal. That's something, but it's not the goal. What do you mean surviving to be? Do you want freedom? Do you want liberty? Do you want to be able to move about freely? Do you want to have the ability to travel? Do you want to have the ability to have communications? How are you going to communicate? Are you going to have electronics? Are you going to have this? Are you going to have that? Define that for yourself. Define what surviving means to you, and that becomes a goal. I want to have food. I want to have shelter. I don't want to be cold in the winter, and I don't want to be hot in the summer. I don't want to be stuck in one place. I don't want to be at threat of marauders. I don't want to be at threat of my neighbors who would do me harm. I don't want to be at threat of having no food or no water. These are things to think about. Define what your goal is. And then, once you've defined it, you can start unwinding and unraveling that like thread off of a spool. And as you do, it will begin to reveal itself to you what the answers are that you need. So, preparedness is the first step in building a reliable ability to survive. Building your preparedness entails considered thought. Building preparedness is an action, but it is passive at the same time. I know that sounds a little confusing, but stick with me and I think you'll understand my point. While preparing, you are acting. You're acquiring things related to your ability to survive crises, disasters, and mayhem. Those things could be skills, knowledge, reference materials, books, manuals, long-term storage like food, water, transportation, and other things. Preparing is a critical step because you will not have the time, clarity of mind, or resources to gather them at the moment of a crisis. Understanding readiness is the second component, because readiness is the second component. Understanding readiness is the key to this. Once you've begun preparing, the next step is to move to survive. It's the point where preparation integrates with actions. Readiness exercises are absolutely the best way to develop a resilient and reliable plan. Once you have amassed your things, your skills, your knowledge, your water, your long-term food supply, your multiple means of transportation, of communication, and others, you set in motion what it takes to survive. Because as I stated previously, again, the fact of the matter is that when you are in the middle of the crisis, there is absolutely no time to gather food, to gather water, to learn how to preserve it so that even if you have no electricity, it will last and you will have food. Because the next step is, if your crisis or disaster exceeds 30 days, which is about the limit for even the most prepared people out there, you end up with a situation that you see currently playing itself out in Venezuela. It's sad. These people had a normal, healthy life. I disagreed with their government, but let's face it, they lived a modern Western lifestyle. And when the collapse of that nation happened, it degraded into chaos. Now you have gangs and walls that are built up that will block people from escaping and from entering both ways. And it's changed the way people live in a dramatic way. You do not want to get there. You never want to be in a position to be trapped in that place. You want to be able to plan ahead. Governments need to learn to plan ahead, and they keep failing miserably at that. But our government has, since 9-1-1 and Katrina, really come to the plate and work with people like Jim and his counterparts around the United States, doing situational runs where they do tabletop exercises and they do full running exercises, including tabletop working together, where they actually act out scenarios where they test their readiness and test their preparedness together on the field in order to make sure that their skills are up, that their gear is up, that you can get to it, that it's functional, that it's reliable. This is critical. And you will never know that your plan worked, that you didn't screw something up or leave something out incidentally until you are trying it out and actually running it up the pole, so to speak, to see it work. That's when you go, oh, holy crap, I forgot this. Oh, I can't believe I forgot that. This is crucial. This is why FEMA, why the fire and safety and rescue squads do readiness drills all of the time. Why police now do readiness drills. Why the Department of Homeland Security and why the U.S. military does readiness skills exercises for years. There is no way on earth that people will go through and prepare by getting things and all that and wait until the moment that they need it in order to touch it for the first time, to try to light that fire for the first time. I have been teaching fire making since the mid-1970s, and I just tried making a fire a few minutes ago, and as I now see, partly because I ignored it to cut the show, to do the show, I realized that I never ended up successfully starting the fire. And I realized, oh my gosh, I just failed at one of the skills that I know that I can tell and prove that I am good at. Why? Because I haven't practiced it in a while. So now what do I have? I have a fire that didn't start. I have a situation that failed. I didn't use my right skills. I didn't use my right things. I went to light it with my favorite turbo lighter that is refillable. And I just found out that ever since I refilled that refillable turbo lighter, that it's failing. So maybe the butane fill tank that I used didn't have good fluid in it, or it failed for some other reason. Maybe I turned it upside down and I got too much liquid, or I didn't get enough liquid. All of these things matter. But do you want to find out that you failed in your planning when you are in the middle of a disaster, when you're cold and you need heat, when you need to cook and you have no fire? Or do you want to figure it out when you're at home and go, "Ooh, holy crap, what have I done? I need to bone up on that tomorrow so that I am not in that position." But readiness brings you to learn where your skills are lacking, where you need more practice, where you simply need to relearn or to add something to your kit or to your mental toolbox that will allow you to succeed the next time. Do not wait until it's too late, because you need to have the absolute best option and the best possibility of succeeding that you can have. It's really important. So readiness, when you have a state of readiness, you are on the edge of your seat. You may be the guy who's a track runner, who's bent over with his hand on the ground and his 2 feet in the stocks that are ready to trigger, to fire off. Excuse me. To push off on the 440 or the sprint that he's about to run around the track. That's readiness. When you have practiced and practiced, you know exactly where to put your feet and in what angle and what way to stand in order to get that extra second of a lead so you can win the race. In this case, the winning the race is surviving. How well you do that and with how little effort that's apparent will bring the level of your happiness and your survival up and up. That's what you want to go for. I watched a video last night of this great guy who was playing guitar, and he plays rockabilly, and he was sitting on his speaker, on his amplifier, next to a lake, playing the guitar for 15 minutes. And he did not even break a sweat. Only one time, right at the very end of the 15 minutes, did he even show any minor deviation from just rolling, just doing it. That is where you want to be with your preparedness abilities, with your readiness abilities. You want to be able to put your head down on the pillow and say, I don't have anything to worry about. I've got this. I've got this. That's where you want to be. Not, oh no, there's a storm coming. Oh, quick, I better run to Walmart. Oh, I better run to ShopRite. I better run to this store or that store to go get myself food and water and what is it? Eggs, milk, and bread for people who half of the time don't even cook ever. What are you going to do with that eggs? I always wondered if they make some idol out of this egg, milks, and bread that then brings them food and water and survivability, because it's not making sense to me. When they don't cook and have these things already, how is it that they think that they're automatically going to go buy them and they're going to survive? And that goes back to my opening point with this, which is if you live in the city, if you don't garden, if you don't know how to grow things, if you've never grown things, or you have no skills at growing things, if you don't know how to save seeds, if you don't know how to create refrigeration methods without electricity, if you don't do these things that are required of you when you are off-grid, when you are in the mountains or in the woods and you are out in the Pine Barrens or in the Poconos or in Shenandoah Valley in Virginia, and you've never encountered a snake and you don't know what to do. You've never come within 1,000 feet of a bear that was loose unless it was behind the bars in a zoo. What are you going to do? How are you going to react? How are you going to maintain order and balance amongst you and the rest of your team? If you have never encountered it and you have no depth of knowledge and no intention or idea of what to do with that, well, the answer in my book would be then learn from that feeling you have right now. And from this moment forward, start developing answers to those questions that don't leave you going, yep, I'm basically screwed because I don't know. Number two, if you have never left the city and you don't have an established location where you're known and liked elsewhere in the rural areas, you are not going to be accepted. You don't have time, nor do you have the ability, even if you could, under the pressures of the situation, if it's the first time they see your face, you are not going to get a warm reception. It's just simply the way it is. So stay in your environment in the city. Figure out what you will take in order to be able to go mobile and yet return to your domicile or create another one or hijack another one if it's bad enough, but to survive in your culture and in your environment. That's what you need to do. It's really crucial. If you don't do that, what's going to end up happening is you are going to be in a situation where you will move and you will end up dying or end up out in the cold, ostracized because you don't fit and they don't like people who are outsiders. It's just simple. This is how it works. Make a plan. Consider that in your goal. Consider that in how you wind back from the goal to unwind it, to peel back that the layers of that onion in order to come up with a plan that will be viable and then put it all together so that everyone who will be dealing with you in that situation will be in a position where they're not guessing, where they too feel comfortable, where they too can make things happen. This is crucial. So bring yourself to readiness. By the way, when you practice what you prepare, there's a shaka, practice preparedness. When you practice what you prepare and you find errors and shortcomings, what you do is you make written note of them and then go back to the beginning and start planning again, considering those new things that you have learned that you take into the consideration of your survival. This is really, really critical, because what happens is that in the end, you will make a better and better plan. You go up, you make it, you go, oops, I gotta fix that, you go back, and then you come back and you fix it again, and you test it out, and maybe you find something else. This is why the police and the fire, the rescue personnel, regularly practice these things, because every time they practice, they learn what they screwed up on, learn what they need to do to fix it, and then learn what they need to do in order to be better at it, so it's more efficient, so they don't waste resources that are limited, so that they're capable of making it through to the next day without massive train wreck of a problem. That's how the world works. So I don't want to beat the horse too far, but it is really critical that you do understand this. It's really critical that you understand that if you properly plan, you may never read the plan, because it won't matter by the time you're done. When you write your plan out, when you put it in writing, when you detail it and break it down, you may not even need the written plan anymore, except to bolster your memory to make you feel better, because in fact, you will have been forced by your own actions to incrementally and fine-tuningly work your way through each and every one of those components, so that in the end, you will have a well-thought-out, very verified plan that you can see happen, that not only you envision happen, but when you practice it, you learn that you can do it, and you get better at it, and quicker, and more precise, and more accurate about what you do, and that's a win. That's a win for you, and that's a win for morale in your group. That's a win all the way around. Because in the end, the only thing that we can count on is ourselves. If we place ourselves in the position where we will ruin everything by planning to not plan, by planning to be dependent upon others, how many times have you ever met anyone in your lifetime who would put themselves out there on the line, who would put themselves in harm's way, and then when you get to that point, they're not there. They're not available. They're not in a position to help you. When you are in that position, there's only one person you can count on, you. If you're lucky enough to have the other people, look at what happened in Katrina. There were lots of well-trained emergency workers in the area. They even knew that the problem was coming for 3 weeks. They moved FEMA personnel. They moved all kinds of personnel in the area, military, to help with rescue and to help with evacuation. And the people refused to heed the call. The politicians caved under political pressure. And then what happened? When the people who were the responders, when their families were at risk, they were looking for self-preservation first. You know, I was writing in my book the other day, in a chapter in my book, that, and I actually had this conversation earlier today. When you get on an airplane, they give you the most primary example of what it means to have self-preservation. They tell you that when the air masks fall from the ceiling, from the cargo compartment, down in front of you, you're to pull it open and make it start flowing and place it on your own face first. Because if you don't do that, anyone else who needs your help will perish, because you will perish while you're helping them. It's a lose-lose. You must understand in survival that self-preservation is one of the fundamental keys to you surviving. That is critical. So when you start out, use that air mask analogy to remind yourself in your plan that taking care of yourself is first and foremost. If you have a family, if you have teammates, you have to depend on yourself first. And this goes back to the other term that I push all the time, which is self-reliance. Because a self-reliant person does not mean that they can do everything. They may be able to do a lot of things, a whole lot of things, more than most people right now. They're not going to do them the best. They're not going to be the best at every one of them, but they will be able to do them in order to make sure they survive. The more they practice it, the better they'll get at it, and the more likely it is that those things will have better outcomes when they do them. But if you don't, you will have none of those things to fall back to, and if you are codependent, if you are dependent, you are lost. A person who is self-reliant, standing shoulder to shoulder, not in a line, waiting for someone else to give them something, but shoulder to shoulder, a group of self-reliant people with skills, with ability to function and survive on their own, are not needy. When they choose to come together and work in concert together, they are an immovable mass, an insurmountable force that will guarantee their survival. Why? Because it's not that annoying thing that will always leave you with the feeling like you gave everything and they gave nothing. That you gave everything and they took without returning. This is crucial. Self-reliant people with other self-reliant people, not codependent people, are the key to surviving a massive or a minimal disaster. Simply put, that should be part of your goal for your planning. Maybe your plan should be a plan to meet a goal of being self-reliant, because then the amount of external input that you need, the amount of external support that you need has been minimized because you yourself are able to provide for yourself. You yourself may not be the best mechanic or the best fire-making person or the best cook or the best whatever, but because you have the skill, because you have practiced it, because you have had the ability to do those things yourself, if you allow someone else around you to do it, you can help, you can input, you can support them because you understand the practice, you understand the procedure, you understand what it takes. And when they're tired or they're stressed or they're forgetting something, you can support them by helping them and prompting them or supporting them because you know what's coming next. So you can help to strengthen their ability with your own. Crucial. Nothing can be better than that, because that goal, in the end, is where you want to be. Then, if you are lucky enough, if you have been graced enough to be surrounded by others who have worked to have a similar self-reliant ability, we'll then be able to work with you where you can work on a common ground, on a strong ground, where there is equal respect and equal ability to do. You will be in a position where all of you who are in that position win. This morning I was reading part of Thomas Hobbes's Of Man, being the first part of Leviathan, in chapter, I think it's chapter 9, it may be chapter 11, of the difference of manners. I highly recommend it. I will put a link on there. It is Old English, so if you're not familiar with it, you may have to read it 15 times and open a second window and Google the words if you don't know what they are, so that you can go back and read it and understand what it says. But he talks very heavily about the interactions between humans and how even those who say they're your friend, those who support you, will undercut you and undermine you because you doing makes them feel lesser. Never overlook that. So I hope that I've made the point enough to get it across to you where what I wanted to help you move forward toward how to create a genuine, viable preparedness and survival plan.
And that, unfortunately, will be it for this edition of the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. I am your host, Will Hemingway. Thank you for spending your time with us today. Don't forget to click the links at the top of practicepreparedness.com, to follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and meetup.com. Until next time, please don't wait until it's too late. Live proactively, act with purpose every day, have a plan, and practice. Because, as I always say, there is no disaster when you are prepared. We hope that you'll join us next time for the Practice Preparedness Radio Show. Have a good day.